Hey, this is Ed. So this is a podcast, is that right?
This is.
Okay. We're officially podcasting right now. That's awesome.
This
is Straight from the Cutter's Mouth.
Welcome to Straight from the Cutter's Mouth, a retina podcast. At least once a week, we're going to bring you insights and perspectives from the world of vitreoretinal surgery. I'm your host, Dr. Jay Schreather, here live from the 2019 American Society of Retina Specialists meeting in this very fancy hotel room, as usual. We don't have reserved digs, and we have our microphone propped on an ironing table. I'm joined by Dr. Sriji Patel to my left from Vanderbilt University. Sriji, welcome.
Thanks for having me, Jay.
Hopefully this isn't too awkward. Ajay Kurian to my right, in bed, but he's wearing a suit. That sounded weird. Ajay, how are you?
Thanks for having me, Jay.
I had to clarify that you were wearing a suit. You were in good clothing. So what are we doing? So we are doing a journal club that's gotten postponed a few times, but we're also going to talk a little bit about the meeting, impressions, things like that. I'm going to ask you guys, we've only been at meeting one day, so there's going to be a lot of other things that come out the next 3 days. We're recording this on Saturday, July 27th, towards the end of the day. But first of all, I'm going to do this journal club. So like all our journal clubs, we'll post the links to the articles online. And I just picked a couple interesting articles from major journals we can talk about. So let's start with this publication from JAMA Ophthalmology. This article was entitled, it's not an entitled article, but the title of the article is Association of Surgical Setting and Deployment of a New Electronic Health Record with Ophthalmic Operative Times by Gulati and Boland. This was published online in the last month. And Sriji, do you want to tell us a little bit about this article, what they kind of showed, and then we can talk about what it means for our practices?
Sure. So this is a study where they looked at the changing operative times before and after implementation of a new electronic health record. This was done between July 2015 and November 2016. And essentially, they were looking at two things. One, what was the change in operative time immediately in three different segments immediately post implementation of a new health record? And then also, what were differences in operative times between ambulatory surgery centers versus a hospital-based OR for ophthalmic surgery? And so essentially what they found was that immediately following implementation of a new EHR, there was an increase in operative time. It was clinically small, but statistically significant. It was 2.9 minutes. In the intermediate phase following implementation, it was 1.2 minutes. And then in the late transition period, it was statistically insignificant difference from before implementation of the new EHR. Additionally, something that they found, which is probably not surprising, is that surgery in the hospital-based setting takes longer, both in terms of intraoperative time, but also turnover time. And this was actually a little bit more probably clinically significant along with statistically significant. It was 15.9 minutes longer during the OR time and an additional 5 minutes of turnover time. It gives us an idea, you know, as we're moving towards more and more electronic health records, the types of effects that it has on OR times. And I think it was a valuable study for that reason.
That's great. That's a really great job, Sriji. And I think there's kind of, like you said, there's two main kind of takeaways. I actually think this study would have been, obviously they have to do it after they implement EHR. I think the first point that increases the time very gradually is nice. It wouldn't have changed anything because unfortunately we're all having to go to EHR regardless. So even if they said it increased it by 45 minutes, I think the ship has already kind of sailed where we have to do it anyway. So maybe it's just comforting that it doesn't increase it that much. They said 5% of the duration of the cases. So there's some increased... we've talked before about benefits of EHR, and you know there's definitely benefits in terms of documentation and access and things like that, but it's not a huge increase. I think this, so to the first point, I think it's comforting. It's showing that if you do it in an efficient manner, you can improve it, but it doesn't necessarily change anything. I think the second part of it is really interesting because Bill Rich was just on talking about this, and a lot of people are talking about this whole hospital versus ASC issue, and we're all in academic settings, right? So like we're used to operating in a hospital. And of course, the ASC is going to be more efficient. I mean, this isn't surprising, as you said. I just wonder, they did publish this data, and it's good that it's out there. I think it's also dangerous in the sense that I don't want someone who's a non-physician looking and saying, well, clearly you should be doing all your surgeries in ASC. Why are we paying more to operate at a hospital if it's less efficient? And definitely, like they said, and to be fair, in their discussion, they said, that, for example, cataracts, simple cases should go in an ASC. I think that's reasonable. But I think we have to be really careful about protecting hospital settings because there are a certain patients who have other comorbidities who are better in a hospital setting, but also there's a certain type of cases that in retina, for example, surgeons in practice practically speaking, just can't do in an ASC, and the ASC doesn't want them to do it there because from a cost-effective spend, it doesn't, for example, a horrible PVR TRD, you know, if an ASC can do 20 cataracts in the same time the surgeon can do it, if it takes 2.5 hours, that's how long it takes, they're not going to want to do that case. And so if you lose the hospital setting as a place of access for these patients, but also B, there's been talk about reducing the extra cost you're paying the hospitals to be success. I think that's dangerous in terms of not helping these complicated patients. But Ajay, anything you want to add or points? I talked a lot more than I do usually. But
the one thing with the time is that I'm just not sure if they controlled for any complexity differences within the cataract cases, especially since sometimes some patients who do come to the hospital do have more complex cases. Certainly not everyone, but maybe that could account for some of the time differences also.
Yeah, they were not actually able to control for case complexity, which gives us an idea that really short, straightforward cases, sure, you could make up some time in an ASC, but we know this very well. There are really complex cases that have unpredictable times and complex patients that would really benefit from the extra staff and the anesthesia attention that you can get at a hospital center setting.
And there's a couple, we usually talk about limitations. I think there's a couple big limitations to mention, right? So one of them is they said that the study period they started with is when the new residents and fellows started. So we were just talking about, God bless our fellows and residents, but I just operated the other day with new fellows, so great, great fellow. But it's a transition. It's July. I mean, it's going to be slower for, even if you just have to teach them the system and they're surgically up to speed. So you don't know. Maybe this is actually even, and it's just from having new people around. I think the second limitation, this is a large academic eye center. This is Wilmer Eye Hospital, right? So like maybe a Wilmer, Cole, Bascom-Palmer, freestanding eye hospitals, is this generalizable to, you know, programs that are academic? But if they're a hospital setting, they're still not an eye-only facility. They may share with other services. That definitely changes your efficiency. And again, like you talked about the complexity, I think that, I don't know, I think that this is something that's interesting to look at. And I just, my only caution would be, I just hope it's not interpreted the wrong way by someone who is just not as familiar with the complexity issue. Because I don't want, you could just read this and just say, oh, ASCs are more efficient, just do everything at an ASC. Ajay, any final thoughts before we move forward?
Those are all great points.
You're so verbose. I'm sorry. It's always tough to be the last person. We're going to move forward into the next one. Sriji, I'm going to let Ajay talk this time because I don't want to steal. So the next paper is a manuscript from American Journal of Ophthalmology, and it's entitled Changes in Management Based on Vitreous Culture and Ophthalmitis After Intravitreal Anti-Vascular Endothelial Growth Factor Injection by Patel et al. Out of Wills. Ajay, endophthalmitis, a topic near and dear to our hearts. We published many papers on endophthalmitis in our time as residents with our mentor, Dr. Harry Flynn, who is a strong believer in vitreous culture for endophthalmitis. But let's talk about what this study showed and then implications. So what did they set to show? So essentially what they wanted to do was look at patients who had endophthalmitis after intravitreal injection with any of the three anti-VGF agents we've had in the last 2 years. And they looked at whether there was any change in clinical management, either an additional injection on top of the original tapin injector for treatment or a vitrectomy, and whether it mattered whether there was a culture that was positive or not and affected either the outcome of visual acuity or the treatment course. So again, they had the access to tons of injections. So they only had 60 cases of endophthalmitis out of over 200,000 injections. 18 of these cases were culture positive, so pretty low percentage, a little less than a third. And they basically saw that there was only a change in three of the culture positive cases versus three of the culture negative cases. There was no significant difference in those values. And why did they change the management? It was based on vision or clinical exam. It wasn't based on the culture results. So the question is, there were no additional interventions based on those culture results. So they basically said that even though it may prognosticate visual outcome to know what the organism is, it doesn't really change your clinical management. So Ajay, staunch Harry Flynn devotee, what do you think? Should we be culturing these patients still if it doesn't actually change your management?
I think there is still a role for culture. You know, first of all, there certainly is a proportion of patients who potentially have non-infectious inflammation after injection. Now, certainly you can't go with a negative culture and say this patient doesn't have endophthalmitis because you're also going to have a proportion of patients who are just culture negative despite having infectious endophthalmitis. But every once in a while, you can be surprised with the culture results and the sensitivities. And so we have presented that there is a increasing rate of vancomycin intermediate resistance to certain streptococcus species, and other enterococcus species have also been presented. And so I think there's still a role for culture and looking at sensitivities just in case you have one of those bugs. It is rare, but I think it does help.
So I'm going to direct the next question to Srigi, but I'm going to play devil's advocate. So one, culture yield is pretty low from this series. And I can tell you, having worked in the system, part of the reason is we were spoiled at a place like Baskin. We had a micro lab for ophthalmology only, so that's unusual. Most places are sending to a general lab. And I'll tell you, we would send it to like the Jefferson lab, and Jefferson's a great hospital, but they usually weren't used to handing eye samples. And so I think that was one of the reasons our culture yield was so low. And so if you're out in practice and you don't know who's handling your sample and you don't know where it's going and the yield is low, there are risks to doing a tap and inject, right? So it's not a benign procedure. If you look back at the EVS, there is a tear or detachment rate associated with that procedure. So again, I'm not saying I believe this, but I understand the devil's advocate argument. It's not a procedure without risk. So maybe in certain circumstances, if you're going to be doing a broad spectrum coverage anyway, it doesn't change management, could there be an argument not to do the tap?
So I certainly understand the argument that can be made in that favor. I'll point out two things. One, you know, we know this with endophthalmitis, the stakes are high. And if you have a patient that's not responding to treatment, that patient can lose vision permanently very quickly. So it's helpful, especially if they have some sort of resistant organism, to have an idea about what the bug could be and what medications it may be susceptible to. Being purely pragmatic, you know, when we inject these antibiotics, in my practice, I inject vancomycin, ceftazidime, and moxifloxacin. So I'm injecting a decent amount of volume, 0.1 for each of these. I know that I'm going to have to relieve some fluid just to keep the pressure in a reasonable range. And so for me, I am attached to an academic setting with a lab that's right there, and they handle ocular specimens. But it makes sense that if I'm going to be retracting this fluid anyway, to just send it to the lab so they can look it under a microscope.
Yeah, and I think that Ajay brought up the point, you brought up the point. There's been series published persistently positive endophthalmitis where, okay, they're not getting better. I'm going to do a vit in culture, do tap and inject in culture. And I guess you could make an assumption and be like, it's persistently positive. I didn't do a culture the first time, but it's still a culture positive. But technically, you don't know.
Sure.
Right? So I guess in theory, even though you're injecting broad spectrum antibiotics, could you have induced a new infection with your injection? Who knows? I mean, like, so it's hard. I'll give you an example. I think that I took a case of serratia last year. That's an organism that is known to give you persistently positive cultures and actually end up not responding to vancomycin ceftazidime and need an amikacin to respond. And it was culture positive three different times. So tap and inject, culture positive, vitrectomy, culture positive, still getting worse, another vitrectomy, I'm still culture positive. And that's when we finally switched the antibiotic at that point, because even though it was technically sensitive, it wasn't responding. It's an interesting question, but I think that, I think the other worry here is, this is a low, I don't know. It's interesting. It'd be interesting to know nationally, what is the rate of culture positivity? Because I only have two experiences. I have my attending and residency experience. We have a very high culture positivity because we have a lab that just handles ophthalmology all day. And in my fellowship experience, where it was lower and we were doing the exact same things, but the lab didn't handle as well. And I'd be curious, maybe I'm wrong. Maybe if you extrapolate it nationally, the rate is higher and it's worth something. So it's just something interesting to think about. Ajay, any final words or thoughts on tap and injects? Do you ever, here's a question that would make Dr. Flynn very upset if he heard the answer to, but do you ever just say, I'm going to do an AC tap injection? So many people in practice will do that. They'll say, well, I'm not going to just inject, but I don't see the risks of vitreous tap. So I'm just going to do an AC tap. I know the yield is lower, but it's less risky.
I haven't done that in a post-injection patient because the nidus of infection is certainly in the vitreous in those cases. There are some times where I do think that that might be useful, for example, in a bleb-related endophthalmitis where the nidus of infection is coming from the front very clearly. But when you're looking at larger studies that compare the AC tap yield versus the vitreous yield, on average, the vitreous yield does provide a higher rate of positivity compared to the aqueous tap.
Well, moving forward, we have Srigi Patel in the flesh here to talk about this. This is published in JAMA Ophthalmology, Analysis of Antivascular Endothelial Growth Factor Injection Claims Data in U.S. Medicare Part B Beneficiaries from 2012-2015. Sean Berkowitz, the first author, with Paul Sternberg, and Srigi Patel, senior author from Vanderbilt. And initially, Srigi's a humble guy. He didn't want to come on and talk about his own paper, but I'm okay with it because I think it's important. And I think it's more useful to hear from you how you designed this and why you did it, and then we're going to sit here and pick it apart in a very polite fashion. But I actually think it's a great paper. So tell me what you think. What did you guys set to do? What inspired this study idea? What did it show? And what are kind of your takeaways when you like look at the landscape of intravitreal injections right now?
Sure. So one of the things that we wanted, there's a lot of dialogue right now about anti-VEGF injection costs. I think it's something that is a little bit of a hot button issue. And we wanted to set out to better understand injection patterns. We had this hypothesis that it's probably top driven. And what I mean by that is there are busy referral practices that see a lot of patients and then do a lot of injections, and that's just the nature of the beast. And my suspicion is that those practices may be leading to these high number of anti-VEGF injections. And what we found is, if you look at the top 100 injecting ophthalmologists, which represents about 3% of the population of retina specialists or ophthalmologists that inject more than 10 injections a year in the Medicare population, they account to about for about 17 to 31% of anti-VEGF injections given nationally. And that's a pretty staggering total. And again, it's not, there's no, the analysis is not meant to assess intention or any reason behind this. You know, we understand that these are busy practices and they do a lot of injections, but it gives you an idea about the distribution mm-hmm. and the breakdown across the country in terms of where these injections are being given.
I mean, this is a very hot topic here at ASRS. They're doing a special session tomorrow about Avastin for sure. 15 minutes. I mean, so I think the interesting thing about this, I think we all knew this, but there's just a couple of, there are a lot of busy people across the spectrum, but there's just a couple of really, really, really busy people. And there's a couple of things there. One is the perception issue. And so one of the things we've seen a couple articles, there was one written in the Washington Post, but actually a retina specialist, Dr. Andrew Lamb, wrote an article, right. I think it was maybe 2 years ago, 3 years ago, that got a lot of criticism within the community. But basically it was to the point that, you know, that they, if you look at the highest Medicare billing providers, not just in ophthalmology, but throughout medicine, many of them are retina specialists. And that's just real. That's not a criticism. That's just stating a fact. And it's interesting to see how that's concentrated. And part of that is there's efficiencies of scale. Once you get above a certain number, there's an efficiency in terms of your imaging equipment and your staff and your scribes. And there's also an efficiency in terms of having medication and delivering medication and getting potentially better costs on your medication with the rebate programs and things like that that exist. So it is a tricky issue. I think that it's interesting to think that it's so staggering, though, that it's a third, right? Lucentis or ranibizumab, for example, a third is 100 different doctors. I have to look at the paper. Were you able to break down how often they were in the same practice? So, like, can you be like, oh, there are 100 doctors, but actually they only come from 9 different practices? I'm sure it's not that dramatic, but yeah. Were you able to break that down?
The data is broken down by provider. It is out there. Honestly, the purpose of this paper was not necessarily to, you know, put an expose on any one particular person's injection patterns. And again, that's not the point of this analysis. So I didn't specifically say how many people came from what practice, because again, I didn't want to necessarily
identify a practice. Yeah, exactly.
This is more just looking at it globally to get an idea about what our distribution is.
And one of the things that will be interesting, right? So if you talk about from a population's need standpoint, Ajay, if they're concentrated in, again, a beautiful map in the paper showing where these are concentrated, but, and obviously the population varies density-wise throughout the country.
Sure.
They don't perfectly match necessarily, right? So that's why we have very saturated areas and with lots of providers, maybe for lots of patients, but the ratio of provider to patients is much higher. And then we have lots of areas that really need providers and they can't get access to it easily. So it's interesting, if you concentrate it in a few people, unless those people are going all over the country, which some practices do travel a bit, but it's doubtful that 100 ophthalmologists can cover the entire country. I'm curious, as we go forward, there's a lot of things that have brought up. If injections do end up being something that are so common, are we going to have doctors be giving these injections? Are ophthalmologists going to be trained to do these injections with the burgeoning need? Are nurse practitioners and even PAs, it's been controversial issues been brought up to address this discrepancy. I mean, it seems that there's definitely a mismatch in terms of, I mean, ideally, the ideal scenario here would be everyone is doing the same number of injections and relative to the density of a state. And it doesn't seem that that's true.
Yeah, I think that different practices are set up differently in terms of how far out they're traveling and how many patients they're set up to see in a given day. And also their referral patterns might be different in terms of whether they're seeing more non-injection patients versus injection patients. For example, in my academic practice, we have a pretty large optometric group, and so that actually makes it so that a lot of times, if a patient is seeing me, it's for an injection, and so that could be the cause for some of these discrepancies that we're seeing. Certainly might not explain everything, but those could come into play. You know, I think that hopefully this is this huge number of injections is not going to be a completely long-term problem, given potentially longer-lasting medications, different delivery devices, and things that could be employed in the future to decrease that burden on both the patients and in the clinic itself. And so maybe that potential of having other practitioners doing the injections won't come to a head if that technology is able to advance faster than the population boom.
You know, Srijit, one last question. I'm curious. So one of the things you guys showed is that if you're going to pick a combination of two drugs that a provider is going to use, the most common ones, you either use bevacizumab and aflibercept or ranibizumab and aflibercept.
Sure.
But it's not as common to use bevacizumab and ranibizumab. And the CAT trial results you guys looked at didn't seem to influence that, but aflibercept approval results in a little decrease in the use of bevacizumab while ranibizumab stayed constant. So how do you interpret that? So like if you're thinking now real world, you're like, okay, so let's say we don't know step therapy in different places, what people have asked, but let's say you start with bevacizumab. It seems like if you start with bevacizumab, people are more likely to go to aflibercept, or they just try to start with ranibizumab. Why do you think there's not that step to ranibizumab from bevacizumab? And again, disclosure-wise, I don't get any funding from any of these companies. Trigi doesn't. Aja, you have some research funding from Regeneron, I think, right?
I'm a consultant for Regeneron and Genentech and receive research funding from Genentech.
Okay, so I'm going to leave you out of this conversation just for a second. Well, I guess... Okay, but anyway, your thoughts. So, like, what do you think? Like, if you think about that, you're like, well, why is that? We've talked about our preferences, and it kind of matches that.
Sure. I honestly think a lot of it comes down to what people feel comfortable with in their hands. I feel like, you know, as doctors, we're really creatures of habit, and we really have experiences with certain medications, and if we have had a lot of success with ranibizumab or aflibercept, we'll always go back to that well. And so I think a lot of the results that we're seeing are actually just people feeling comfortable with the medications that they're used to using, and that's kind of where they go. And so for me, for example, I typically start out with bevacizumab, and my practice usually dictates that if people are not responding, I go straight to aflibercept. I have colleagues that will start with ranibizumab because they feel that that has certain benefits, and they'll usually stick with that, or they may go to aflibercept. So I think a lot of it is just, as opposed to, it's not nefarious, it's just people are driven by certain past experiences and their comfort level.
We're going to move forward. One last quick paper. I thought it was just funny, interesting, because it ties into some things we talked about probably in residency. If we worked at a VA, you worked in a VA at Vanderbilt?
I did.
Yeah, so we're used to using EHR from the time, CPRS, for example, there. And so this is about redundancy of progress notes for patients who get serial office visits. So, Aja, you want to talk a little bit about, it's a very short report in ophthalmology. Do you want to talk about this?
Yes, this was a great paper coming out of the Portland group where they were looking at differences in progress notes, and so they weren't including the physical exam in these in this assessment, but just sort of your assessment and plan. Differences in the essentially the words between a single note and then the follow-up note. They also did compare between random notes just to make sure that there was a difference between those. They used a software that was able to compare it, and then they also used a manual assessment for a smaller subset. With two graders. They found pretty good concurrence between the software and the manual grading, but what was interesting was that it was a very high percentage of redundancy. So about 75% of the text was found verbatim in the progress note from a patient's initial visit to their follow-up visit. and in order to make sure that this wasn't just because these patients had similar diseases and things like that, when they compared the non-paired notes, they didn't find too high of a redundancy there. And so that was only about 19.3%. And so this was a very interesting study because it does show that there's a large amount of repetition, which is not surprising given the setup for EMR with templates and the ability to copy forward. It didn't assess for whether this was correct redundancy, and so certainly there can be certain things to stay exactly the same between the assessment plan. If somebody's totally stable, or if you're doing just another injection for a patient, there could be a good reason for it to be redundant. But I think that we've all seen what I commonly call a copy forward error when looking back at some notes when you might have kept something in that note that you didn't mean to keep, or you would have updated a number for the injection or the date of the injection that was missed. And so it does show that high degree of redundancy, but it's not clear if that degree of redundancy is because of error or planned redundancy.
This is a leading question, Strigi, but does this surprise you at all?
No, you know, what I would say is, you know, I have Epic at Vanderbilt, and so I see a lot of copy forward.
Exam and note.
And mm-hmm. one of the things actually that I thought was actually beneficial is, you know, they specifically looked at the plan section, and they saw that the plan section was changed quite a bit.
Right,
which is, you know, that's really the meat of what you're looking at. You know, a lot of Epic has copy forward medication lists and things like that, so there's going to be a lot of text that just gets unchanged from visit to visit. But if people are paying attention to the exam and the plan, that tells us that we're really, you know, looking at these patients and figuring out what we need to do for them each time we come on in. So it's not surprising. And I'm happy to hear that we're actually changing the plans around a bit.
Yeah, I think it's interesting. I think the flippant thing we used to say once EHR kicked in is that anyway, 90% of the note is kind of useless, and you end up just reading the assessment plan from a consulting team or your medicine or anything. And that's sad, but it's because there's all these things you have to put in for compliance, medical history, social history, to show that you covered that, and that doesn't change that much. And Epic is one of those systems. I use Epic too. It creates the note, final note, based on all these things that are pulled forward, which is why when the patient gets their records or you get a patient's records, you're flipping through it to find what's actually important, because a lot of it actually isn't that helpful. MDI is the same way we get MDI notes. I mean, a lot of these systems are the same. I'm referencing to VA because I don't know if you remember when we were first year residents, but people would copy forward like the age and it would never change. So the patient would stay like 72 for like 7 years. And like that stuff would drive me crazy. So I think it's just, but Epic and other MD, now they've gotten smart. You can actually design like smart tools that automatically update the age, the IOP, mm-hmm. the date, the things like that. And that's helpful, but it's important legally, because I remember one of the things I was taught in terms of liability, that if your records appear inaccurate, then it can reduce the confidence. They can use that to kind of say, well, you can't trust anything in this record because it's wrong, right? And so that actually, the more errors you have in your records, the worse it is. If you're ever in a legal situation where someone could be like, well, anyway, how do you trust any of the documentation when they said that this is a woman and not a man? And they said that it was a right eye, but it was actually a left eye. And so that's why I think it's kind of relevant and important.
Yeah, I agree 100%. That's definitely a big worry. And like you said, the templates do help a lot with that, with the way that they're able to incorporate certain things like gender and age. But I think it also, the templates are responsible for a lot of redundancy, because you try to have your templates be as broad as possible so that they can cover a bunch of different diseases and continue to be something where you have to make minimal changes, because that's how you can be the most efficient in the EMR system, is to minimize the number of changes you have. And so that's how all my templates are set up. But, you know, even despite the best efforts, I know that I've personally caught myself having some errors with the copy forward. But since you're seeing a lot of these patients so frequently, you can actually go back and addend the note and things.
We're going to break, but I'm getting a little over. So I'll just ask quick thoughts from day one of ASRS. Anything you saw that you really liked? Or I could say, if you guys want to think for a second, I can say something. I like the surgical video camera. I was in it, but there was that crazy case. I love worms, so they had a case where they pulled out like that worm
around
the retina, and it was like in the cyst, and I don't know. I always love seeing those cases. It's really, really satisfying. Christina Wang showed a case of a DSEC that she had to like take out from the back, and then started a discussion. People were saying we could use a frag to eat the DSEC, and then is it wrong to eat a cornea with a fragmentome? Like, does that make you feel a little guilt? It's like we always were. It's like, oh.
It won't cause PPK at least.
That's good. No wound burn. Yeah. At some point. Srigi, anything that came up from today?
I thought there was a great discussion about subretinal fluid, immaculate degeneration. It's something that we're gathering more and more data about, and we still don't know, and that leads to great discussions. I know personally I'm a little bit more tolerant about subretinal fluid.
Than we used to be.
Than we used to be.
Yeah.
There are some people that are still, you know, drawing the line in the sand that they want that subretinal fluid gone. And so it's really interesting to see if we're going to figure this one out.
Yeah, those are great discussions. I think we certainly need more data before we can figure out the final answer to that question. I really enjoyed watching the video from Dr. Rizzo with using the amniotic membrane.
And you would love that video.
Subretinal space for dry AMD and hemorrhagic subretinal hemorrhage. The subretinal hemorrhage results weren't as impressive as the dry AMD with geographic atrophy results, where there actually was some improvement in visual acuity using the amniotic membrane in that subretinal space. And so it'll be interesting to see that in a larger cohort.
So he apparently showed that at Club. I didn't go to Club Vit, but apparently he showed that same video. And I think the one qualifier to that, it's a super awesome technique in terms of the results, but the reproducibility is going to be tough because he's using fresh AMT from an embryo. So he's not using an AMT that was in your cabinet or in your fridge. You know, so I don't know if you get the same result if you just have AMT that was created versus he's actually getting it from like his path lab, which I think and it would be much harder to do in the United States.
Yeah, we certainly wouldn't be able to do that technique, but I think it's an interesting area. I know I've experimented with the amniotic membrane for the macular hole, which he presented last ASRS with some positive anatomic and visual acuity outcomes. I know there's a few different groups that are doing that, and so it's exciting to see that. It'll be interesting to see if we can put together a study looking at something like this, as well as looking at his long-term results since he's already been doing this for a while.
Ajay Kurian and Shruji Patel, thank you so much for joining me, and great having you guys here. And again, we'll do another recap probably at ASRS at the end over the phone maybe the next week. Thanks, guys.
Thank you. Sorry.
Thanks, Jay.
As always, you can listen to this episode and all prior episodes on our website, retinapodcast.com. That's RETINAPodcast.com. All episodes, including this one, can be found there sorted by category. You also find our blog, Equal Round and Reactive, Lessons from Our Pupils. Remember, you can now claim CME credits for select podcast episodes via the AAO website. Simply log in as an AAO member and visit the link in the episode description. A list of financial disclosures are appended to this episode for your review. On the website, you can sign up for a mailing list to get updates on the most recent episodes. At the bottom are links to subscribe in the Apple Podcast Store as well as the Android Store. You can find us on Facebook, find us in the Apple Podcast Store, or Android Store directly. We are on Twitter at Retina Podcast. And to contact us, click on the contest link on our website or email us at retinapodcast@gmail.com. It was really great seeing so many people at the ASRS 2019 meeting. The feedback we get, both positive and constructive, is super helpful. And please, if you ever think of episode ideas, something you want to hear, just let us know. A lot of these things we can achieve, and many of our best episodes have been inspired by listener ideas. We also appreciate everyone who has left positive reviews in the Apple Store, and please continue to do so. Many thanks to Dr. Shruji Patel and Ajay Kurian for joining me. Thanks to Dr. Louis Kai, Dr. Angela Zhang, and Dr. Michael Benincasa for preparing this episode. Listeners, thank you for what you do on a daily basis, the patient care you provide, the articles you read and publish, and the conversations you inspire. We'll have our next episode next week in August. This is Jay Schreather signing off.
Feeling.
This is straight from the cutter's mouth.